So yeah, just repeating myself. So you're looking at we'll do the four suttas from Anguttara Nikaya 11, and that's with Wisdom Publication, which not every one of you guys will have in electronic. You may be referring to Achan Sujato's Sutta Central, which will have naturally a different numbering, rendering, location, and be very, very difficult to find. So I'll start with, of the four suttas, I'll start with this one, which is on page 744, which is called Accomplishments. And the Buddha was giving a teaching to the monks, and he said, "Bhikkhus, there are these five disasters." What five? Disaster due to loss of relatives, disaster due to loss of wealth, disaster due to illness, disaster regarding virtuous behavior, and disaster regarding views. It is not because of a disaster due to loss of relatives, or a disaster due to loss of wealth, or a disaster due to illness, that with the breakup of the body after death, beings are reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower worlds, in hell. It is because of a disaster regarding virtuous behavior and a disaster regarding views, that with the breakup of the body after death, beings are reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower worlds, in hell. These are the five disasters. So to clarify on that first section, as the Buddha was talking about the five disasters, these major five major areas for the experience of human beings, so the Buddha is actually putting emphasis here that disaster regarding virtuous behavior and regarding like views, we're talking about more in line with the right view that the Buddha was teaching in the suttas. So when a person actually deviates from the path, when they lose the path, when they have views which are essentially in conflict or in opposition to Dhamma, that is considered to be a disaster regarding views. And as all of you know, disaster regarding virtuous behavior essentially is going to be a person who can't, say, maintain the five precepts, because, you know, largely because you're looking at karma, conditioning, you're looking at association with unwholesome people. You know, there's all sorts of things which can happen historically or even socially, which compromises a person's morality, because not every person, no matter how they try internally to regulate their moral behavior, they could be compromised by a dozen different factors externally. You know, if you're a son or a daughter who grows up, say, like in a criminal family where mum and dad have criminal tendencies, and also the uncles and aunties are within that particular field, you know, you're associating with and you're going to be affected by those people. And, you know, we've had, say, for example, people up at Karnet Prison who are quite intelligent, quite well educated, but they essentially were associating with the wrong type of people, people with, say, like unwholesome tendencies. And one thing the prisoners will tell you and the prison officers, that one of the major principles why people re-engage in criminality and re-offend and end up back in the prison system again is because of association with unwholesome people. You know, you're spending hours. You know, if you're living within a family, you could be in the same household with these people easily 8, 12, up to 16 hours a day. So, you know, you're looking at this conditioning process affecting your mind externally, and you've got to be quite strong to be able to resist the behaviours and the attitudes of people who are close to you. So, yeah, and that and as the Buddha explained, that the disaster due to loss of relatives, wealth, and illness is a secondary principle, is something which is not as important as that development of right view and the development and maintenance of say, good morality, good sila. It's not of any, say, real importance or significance, which people who live in general society, really may dispute that, because as far as the vast majority of us are concerned, and including the monastics as well, that our parents, our brothers and sisters, and our children can be quite important to us. I mean, our world circles around our family and friends. And, loss of wealth, very, very few people essentially want to be financially ruined. We've seen examples of people who were multimillionaires and in the space of 3 months were had their companies, misappropriated by the a major banking corporation. And they go from being a CEO of a mining company, which has been operating here in WA for quite a number of years, say minimum 10 to 15, and that person just loses everything and is living in a caravan park and barely has enough financial resources for groceries, for food, So you see that kind of extreme. So, this is not to be, on a worldly level, the loss of relatives, wealth, and illness is not a small thing when our physical health is compromised. It affects the whole quality of our life. But when you're looking at the big picture, when you're looking at the big picture as far as ultimate reality is concerned, then the Buddha's coming from a very, very high perspective. The vast majority of us who are living in the world, you have to function in general society. You just can't cut yourself off and practice as you choose. You've got to work, you've got to pay bills, you've got to raise children, you have many duties and responsibilities. But on an ultimate level, coming from the highest perspective, the Buddha made it very clear that the loss or disaster regarding morality and regarding, say, right view, wholesome view, right view, is far more important than all those other principles that we experience in worldly life. Second paragraph. Bhikkhus, there are these five accomplishments. What five? Accomplishment in relatives, accomplishment in wealth, accomplishment in health, accomplishment in virtuous behavior, and accomplishment in view. It is not because of accomplishment in relatives, accomplishment in wealth, or accomplishment in health, that with the breakup of the body after death, beings are reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world. It is because of accomplishment in virtuous behavior and accomplishment in view, that with the breakup of the body after death, beings are reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world. These are the five accomplishments. So what the Buddha is pointing to here is accomplishment on a worldly level of relatives, wealth, and health is karmically does not have the power in relation to the other two factors. The accomplishment in right view and morality has karmically more power to take you to the Devaloka realms, or potentially even higher, depending on the depth and the power of your meditation. That has far more ability. And essentially, the only word I can really use is say spiritual power, karmic power, the ability to take you to a very high heaven world for a very, very long time. So these worldly, in assessment, these worldly principles, which are quite important to the vast majority of us, the vast majority of us are not, there's only a very small number a fraction of 1% who've actually attained to Dhamma, whose minds are so pure and so exalted and so unattached that they can rise above worldly conditions. They can move in the world, but they are not affected. They are not drawn into all the social, family, personal issues that all of us go through, say in family life, in community life. When those two major factors that development of right view and good morality, you know, that's where you see the parami. The power of the parami will take you to that high heaven world for a significant period of time. And as I've mentioned before, I think from memory, you're looking at the realm of the four great kings, 9.7 million years. So that's an incredible time span where if you're able to maintain your focus and your intention and determination, that realistically you should be able to break through to the Sotapanna level, even if you're reborn in that world for 100,000 years compared to 100 years in the human realm. You can go a long, long way. So what I'll do is I'll stop after each sutta and I'll just check if you guys have any views or opinions with at the end of each of these four sutras. So no one needs to speak whatsoever. Okay. And I'll move on to the next one, which is the Tikandaki Sutta. And in Wisdom Publishing, that's page 757. It's one, and the numbers are 141/1. And the description is, having given, one despises. And the Buddha was teaching, because there are these five kinds of persons found in the world. What five? The one who gives and then despises. The one who despises as a result of living together. The one gullible for gossip. The capricious one. And the one who is dull and stupid. And how is a person one who gives and then despises? Here, one person gives another a robe, alms food, lodgings and medicines, and provisions for the sick. It occurs to him, I give, he receives, or she receives. Having given to them, they despise that person. It is in this way that a person is one who gives and then despises. And how does a person despise as a result of living together? Here, one person lives together with another for 2 or 3 years. They then despise the other because they have lived together. It is in this way that a person despises as a result of living together. And how is a person gullible for gossip? Here, when praise or dispraise is being spoken about another person, they readily believe it. It is in this way that a person is gullible for gossip. And how is a person capricious? Here, a person's faith, devotion, affection, and confidence are fickle. It is in this way that a person is capricious. And how is a person dull and stupid? Here, a person does not know which qualities are wholesome and which qualities are wholesome and which unwholesome qualities are blameworthy and which blameless qualities are inferior and which superior. He does not know dark and bright qualities along with their counterparts. It is in this way that a person is dull and stupid. These bhikkhus are the five kinds of persons found in the world. So if I go back to the beginning, with a synopsis. For example, one thing that you see When you have, say, individuals within a group, within families, or in a community, and you have people who have very, very strong parami, who are very generous, giving, caring, supportive, those particular qualities are very, very, very good qualities that one develops on the path. You know, you see this very, it's almost like a very open-hearted, very like the mind is very, very free. You know, it's not constantly grasping and trying to control and trying to constantly gain and hold things for oneself. You know, as you've seen examples in the sutta where Ananda Pindika would delight in giving and sharing. It's you know, we're not just talking, oh, I feel, you know, quite good about this. It's a real deep sense of joy. You know, when you activate this kind of principle, this kind of parami, it brings you so much more happiness. And Ajahn Brahm's brought this point up a number of occasions, and they've done this in psychological studies where people gain a greater degree of happiness by giving a gift, whether it's a small gift or something of real significance, of real value, to another person. They gain more happiness by giving to another person, by actually receiving that gift for themselves. It's a, you know, you're looking at a law inside the mind. It's something that not everyone has an intuitive feel or understanding for, but it's something that for people whose faculties are clear and sharp enough and they're intuitive enough, it's something which is quite obvious to them that the feeling of joy is much greater to give than it is to receive. And with the second principle, and where a person despises as a result of living together. And as all of us know that you know, when we live close with other human beings, that there's going to be at least a small degree of say friction or contention or differences, because you know every single one of us have very different personalities, and so you're going to see a basis for friction there. You know, with so you know with person, you know, if you're looking at in a nutshell, when you look at personality view between individuals, you know, it's impossible to be like a robot or like a clone of the people, the individuals around us. You know, we have our own views and opinions of absolutely, you know, everything in the world. And with people's personal experience, if emotions are very strong, if the sense of self is very strong, they may feel that their experience is far more in line with reality than your personal experience, because you know they can only look out from within themselves. They can only look through their own eyes. They can't necessarily stand in your shoes and see your perspective. But now you're looking at a mix of faculties there. If the sense of self is strong, it's going to distort and delude the way a person perceives things. You know, it's going to affect just how, you know, how comprehensive the mind is, the ability to examine and to accommodate and accept other people's views and opinions. So my Christian friend, he really insisted that his two daughters actually travel and go to Europe and possibly the States and other parts of the world if they financially could, if they were financially able to do that while they were young. Because he knew for a fact, you know, as a teacher, he's a primary school teacher, his wife's a primary school teacher, and he did that for a number of years, and he knew that traveling and visiting different locations and meeting different people and being exposed to different cultures and attitudes and ways of life, that it would actually broaden the scope of their mind. It would make them more well-rounded in their mentality, their ability to understand other people, to mix and socialize with other people to accommodate other people's views and opinions. But there's also the principle as well where when living together, one despises when living together, that they just make the similar principle, but they just don't. They may not like your personality traits. And how is a person gullible for gossip? Here, when praise or dispraise is being spoken about another person, they readily believe it. It is in this way that a person is gullible for gossip. Well, you know, when you look at the amount of stuff which is on the internet, you know, every man and his dog has a view or opinion on absolutely everything in the world. And but you know, from what I see, I mean, people, you know, but I've even seen very intelligent, broad-minded people who will believe things that I will absolutely not believe whatsoever. And these people aren't silly. They're smart. They've got lots of personal experience, lots of interpersonal connections with other people. But it all depends what you want to believe. The more you know and understand, the less rigid your mind is, the less rigid your view. So if you know, for example, my father, I mean, he has studied intensely. He's like a scholar, you know, from age 15 and right through to age 80, just constantly studying and learning and absorbing more and more and more and more knowledge and information. And what he does, he's not a meditator. So what he's done, what he is, his makeup is like the Vipassana type personality, where he's trying to absorb as much knowledge as possible, and yeah, other people's views and opinions, you know, historical events and facts and you know, millions and millions of views and opinions and events, and he processes like a computer. He's processing all that, and then he gets this very, you know, quite accurate synopsis on what is actually happening on either, say, a social, political, military, or psychological level. You know, because of the vast knowledge base, and all of us have met people who have incredible knowledge, and it is very, very useful like that, in that way, on the worldly level. You know, it's very difficult for me to, I can argue with my father on certain principles, but I can't match him on any level whatsoever when it comes to history, politics, military campaigns, these major worldly events that we see, even the local news. I don't waste my time. We discuss things. I have my views and opinions on stuff, but you know, just because of the knowledge base, he has a very, very sharp synopsis on what is actually going on in general society, but that knowledge of his will never, it is useful to a degree in certain areas, but that kind of vast worldly knowledge will never get you to an extensive extent on the development of the Buddhist path. It will never get you enlightened. You know, instead of the mind moving out into the world and looking and checking and verifying and absorbing, you've got to go internally. You have to go into the personality. The only way to realize the Dhamma the Buddha taught is you have to go right to the very center of your being, the one's nature, to the center of the mind, into deep meditation, where you realize the cessation of all conditions whatsoever in Nirodha Samapatti, the cessation of feeling and perception, where absolutely everything ends. And as far as conditioning, naturally physical, and any kind of mental phenomena. That's why the Buddha called it the highest bliss, the highest happiness, because it's the absolute cessation of all physical and mental activity, and the person realizes Nibbana, and Nibbana is the unconditioned, and this is why it is the ultimate state of bliss and stillness. And how is a person capricious? Here a person's faith, devotion, affection and confidence are fickle. It is in this way that a person is capricious. Fickle in the sense of it wavers, it's not stable, it's not steady. So when we look at those qualities, faith, devotion, affection and confidence, as qualities within the mind, they don't have any real, say, strength or stability or power to them. And that next point, number 5, and how is a person dull and stupid? Here a person does not know which qualities are wholesome and which are unwholesome, which are blameworthy and blameless, which qualities are inferior and superior. They do not know dark and bright qualities along with their counterparts. It is in this way that a person is dull and stupid. Dull and stupid, I mean, as an extreme statement, you could say that. But say, for example, we've got, just an example, you've got situations up at Carnet where, there's been people in Carnet with PhD qualifications who end up being snatched or convicted on criminal offences. So even though as smart as they are, their morality was not as at the same level as their brain power, their ability to think and remember, things like brain speed. One thing you see quite clearly in intelligent people is the ability to think and remember, and the speed of the mind. We have very, very smart people. We have average people whose their senses are not maybe super sharp. But this is all karma. Regardless of whether people's personal qualities are high or intermediate or at a lower level, you're looking at karma, and so. With each individual, if a person is doing the best they can with what they've got, that would be more than good enough for myself. So, but this whole business that with morality, that last section, you've really got to see morality and sila as a valuable principle. So. You've got to have at least a speck of wisdom, at least to a small degree, to see that these there are certain states which are well worth cultivating, and there are states that you should really, undermine or avoid whatsoever, because you have that underlying belief in karma and rebirth. You've got enough intuitive intelligence, awareness that this is the right way for me to live my life as a Buddhist, as a Christian, as a Muslim, or a person within Judaism, the religion of the Jewish faith. So you've got to, and that can come from karma. Some people are not naturally born with that, and some people are not raised by their parents with that kind of mindset. We had a situation one day where a family went up to Carnet to visit the gentleman. The dad went up to Carnet prison to visit his brother with his wife and his teenage boy, And it's pretty amazing. They as they came back from the prison, they pulled up at the bottom of the monastery wall, and the son jumped out. He was probably about, I'm only guessing, about 14 or 15, jumped out, and he walked across the field to one of the kutis, and then he just started helping himself to stuff in the kuti. So he found a laundry bag and just started stuffing stuff in the laundry bag as much as he could, you know, little bits and pieces. There was an MP3 player, there was little bits and pieces, there was a little torch and a few other little knickknacks, and he stuffed the bag with all the stuff he could find, which wasn't much. It wasn't much of any real value, and he grabbed the battery that we used to charge the solar panels. So we walked off with this big bag and a nice car battery, a deep cycle car battery. And as he was walking across the field back to the car, Dad was sitting at the side of the road with the motor idling for a quick getaway. And one of the senior monks saw the kid, you know, comes down and say, "Look," he said, "What are you doing?" He said, Where'd you get all that stuff?" And the kid said, "Oh," he said, I found it in the forest. You know, there's a young teenager without any sort of real sense of morality." But the thing is that mum and dad, you know, this is the way they raise their child. They send their child out to basically go rob one of the monks' kutis, which gives you an idea where mum and dad, you know, might be at. So it was pretty funny. But and then the kid, and so, you know, the senior monk started to get in this kid's face, and the kid said, "Look," he said, he started swearing and this and that. And he put the stuff down and walked off, and then the senior monk said, "Oh," he said, "Look," he said, I've got your number plate number," and he said, "I'm going to call the police," and the kid said, "If you do that," he said, "I'll set fire to your monastery," and he ran across, he jumped in the car, you know, the car was idling, and then mum and dad they took off. Okay, let's see. Okay, so the third sutta is, sorry, yep, please. Despite what does it actually mean in that context? It's like. Well, it's like that. You know, when you, it's like aversion. It's like dislike, pushing away whatever kind of behaviors or qualities that person is exhibiting. Essentially, there's a sense of like pulling away of rejection. The qualities that person has, it's like you can't accept it, you can't understand it, you may feel it doesn't have any value, or it's just complete foolishness. It's like that aversion. The word aversion is something that we can understand maybe in a better context, but it's like it could be dislike for any reason.
Dislike what?
Despising for what?
Despising what? It seems they despise the person.
Well, they despise. They despise
the act itself of giving. Is it meaning he regrets it or what?
Say for example, they may feel that. I've heard people say this, that when they see generous people who help and support others, they really think those people are foolish. And I've heard someone who should know better say about one of our disciples who is incredibly generous and incredibly supportive, that person was a silly person. And I thought, if you really think that means you don't really understand and see the value of that level of support, that the kindness, the sharing, compassion, generosity, giving, the person who thinks, oh, you know, you're really silly, people are going to rip you off, you'll end up with nothing, you'll end up a pauper, you know, with nothing. But the thing is that person told me, the person who had the incredible generosity and mentality of support told me categorically, even though that person is constantly giving and giving and giving to others and supporting, that every time she needs something, every time she needs support, or she's stuck, or she has some difficulty, or there's some obstruction, there's always someone there every single time to help her. Every single time. And my father has this experience as well. Mm. My father's is quite a good person, as long as you don't cross him, because then he will like fix you in some way or another. But my father's been in that situation as well, where he has that side of kindness and support. If he can help you and support you, as long as you do the right thing. And I've seen him in situations where he was stuck. My father's he's at the degree level. He could probably just barely handle a degree, but he's got, you know, he's street smart, really street smart, multiple skills with building, engineering, electric, all sorts of different things. You can build a house, you can do absolutely everything. But every time he got stuck or he needed assistance, there was always someone there, always. Not like, I mean, it might take a couple of days, but like the thing, just even little things like he was interested in getting like a gym set, you know, setting up a gym set in his garage. And then one or two days later, he drops my mother off at her craft embroidery group, you know, with the girls. And as he's coming back, there's a full bench with a box of weights, you know, just sitting out the front of somebody's house. You know, I mean, and this kind of stuff could be worth, I'm only guessing, it's got to be well over, even at that time, well over $500, $750 worth. My father just knocks on the door, says, you know, I saw this gym set out the front of your house. Is it possible to take it away? And the father said, yeah. He said, and the gentleman of the house said, yeah. He said, no problem at all. And he said, plus, he said, I've got some extra discs and some collars. And my father ended up with a full weight training set with racks, the bars, and a bench in good condition. I mean, why anyone would give some, and bicycles. These, you know, he picked up a couple of good quality bicycles and he fixed them up. He touched them up and he gave them to some of the local children. So like, you had single mothers with a couple of kids, two or three kids, and they're just, you know, they're working two or three jobs and they're just running around like crazy, putting their kids through private school, taking them back and forth to school, back and forth to classes. So, you know, so certain things like that, he would fix something up and then he would give it to a person who was poor or disadvantaged on the estate where he lived. Did that make sense to you, or
that kind of makes sense? But I must say that does not appear, the meaning does not come out from that sentence. I mean, as opposed to your rendition, you know. I mean, that's all. I mean,
right.
And for paragraph two, you know. What does it mean? I mean, live together and then he despises the other because they have lived together. I mean, exactly what does that mean?
Well, you may not like that person. You know, there's certain qualities they have that you don't like. You know, it's impossible to like and just love everyone we come in contact with. I mean, it was a classic, you know, like. When I was nursing, I mean, one of the girls there said something like, she got into a tiff with one of the other girls in the class, and she said, like, I don't expect everyone to like me, you know, and it's true. The vast, you know, as Buddhist practitioners, the vast majority of us, what's the right words? You know, we can flex, we can accommodate, we can get along, you know, because we compared to the average person in society, we have a more intuitive feel for other people. We have a more big mind principle where we can listen, we can accommodate, we can get along, we can discuss principles that we may not necessarily agree with, but we can discuss. You know, we don't push the person away. Mm-hmm. We don't say, I don't want to speak to you. Say for example, if a Muslim family just rolled up to our monastery, I mean, full-on Muslim practitioners, the whole family, mum and dad, and three or four children just rolled up at our monastery at lunchtime, I would have absolutely no resistance whatsoever for them to stay and have lunch with us. Absolutely no resistance at all. And but you know, because within the Buddhist framework, and every single one of us who's practiced for at least 12 months, 5, 10 years, we understand like the nature of people, of personality and views and opinions. We've got this more like big mind principle, a more broad encompassing kind of mentality. Like I couldn't roll up, not necessarily, I can't guarantee it, I couldn't just roll up at a very, very, say, strict Christian Orthodox facility at lunchtime and just walk in and say, do you guys mind if I sit down with you and have lunch, you know, just completely out of the blue. Without, I couldn't guarantee that they would allow me to do that. But if anyone, as long as they're not a screaming like maniac, I really don't care who, you know, virtually anyone can come into our monastery, and if they need lunch, if they're hungry, if they're homeless, you know, for them to take our food, to take a plate of food or even take a small bag of food away because they're starving or they've got no money or their car's broken down or this or that, it's nothing for us. On a monthly basis, you know, we've got half a ton of food. You know, we've got so much food that we're constantly sharing with community services, with refugees. You know, even single mums, I make it a point with the single mums in our Buddhist fraternity. If those guys are lean for cash, I'm more than happy to give them $500 worth of stuff and not even blink. It's not a big deal. For us, because they've been moving in our fraternity for at least, you know, 1, 2, 3 years. Even if they're a complete stranger, I would still support them. If they're really in trouble, I would still, you know, outside the Buddhist, you know, they could be someone from a cult, even that. But if they were starving, I would still give them, you know, like a huge bag of food to take away. It's not a big deal for us. Did that make
that makes more sense now?
Sorry, the what?
That does make more sense now.
Right. You can always clarify. You know, I don't expect you to understand everything we're discussing, but we can always clarify it later. Sometimes you have to word search. You know, I mean, I went to look for the background. The statements in relation with this sutta. I couldn't find it on Wisdom Pubs. I couldn't find it on HTML. The explanations for key words, and it just wasn't available when I checked it. So.
Yeah, I could think of a simpler example for number one. So. What I was thinking is that maybe it's like the person who gives to the Salvation Army or to...
Just speak up a little bit.
Maybe it's like the person who gives to the Salvation Army or gives to charity, and that charity is to support the homeless or the disadvantaged. But when, or a beggar, but when coming face to face with that homeless person or that beggar, they actually despise them. They're repelled. They're given, but when faced with the reality, they're kind of resentful for that.
Well, it all depends. Yeah. It all depends who you are. I mean, well, how much resistance. I mean, you will have people like this, but yeah. The bottom line, it all depends on your own personality.
I totally get that. I wasn't personalising it. It was basically just an example to help understand number one.
Mm.
Anyway, for what it's worth.
Yep, no problem. Okay, so Sutta. We're moving on to the third sutta, which is on page 762, and the designation is 146/6. The friend, to take as a friend. Bhikkhus, one should not take as a friend a bhikkhu who possesses five qualities. What five? They instigate work projects. They take up disciplinary issues. They are hostile towards eminent bhikkhus. They are intent on lengthy and unsettled wandering. They are unable to instruct, encourage, inspire, and gladden one from time to time with a Dhamma talk. One should not take as a friend a bhikkhu who possesses these five qualities. Bhikkhus, one should take as a friend a bhikkhu who possesses five other qualities. What five? They do not instigate work projects. They do not take up disciplinary issues. They are not hostile towards eminent or senior bhikkhus. They are not intent on lengthy and unsettled wandering. They are able to instruct, encourage, inspire, and gladden one from time to time with a Dhamma talk. One should take as a friend a bhikkhu who possesses these five qualities. So, the first point, that person instigates work projects. And, you know, even with the monks, you have monks. You know, you're looking. This is reasonably a kind of simplistic kind of presentation, but it's much more complicated than that, because I know monks or even nuns who instigate work projects who are still very, very good practitioners, who are conscientious, energetic, very moral. Can take responsibility, who can teach, who have a daily practice, who are up at 3, 4:30 in the morning and go to bed, as late as possible, 10, 11, 12 midnight. And, they have a good daily personal routine, but they have the skills to develop and undertake and take responsibility for big work projects or undertakings. And so I would, that it's a, that particular, you can argue the point on this, because it's not just the work projects themselves, because certain projects are absolutely necessary, and these projects that we see in our monasteries at present, at Bodhinyana we don't have we've got Hermit's Hill, and that's like an intermediate sized project. Venerable Santuti's monastery there at Stocker Road is an intermediate, so is Venerable Muda's down in Albany. But the thing is that those particular projects are quite crucial. They are absolutely necessary. Now we've got so many people who want to ordain, and we have so little space in the monastery that, you know, hopefully within the next several years we'll have accommodation and facilities available for the male monastics, because, you know, they are male based facilities, but eventually, you know, depending on the dynamics, money, space, they possibly might. I would imagine it out, you know, because you've got Stocker Road. I think it's about, I'm not sure, it's about 27 acres. Venerable Mudu's place, it's well over 100, and that's 160, I think, in total. So there may be the potential, especially for Albany. You've got a big property that the lay women disciples may be very interested, possibly in having accommodation in the future, or having maybe the male and female lay disciples may be interested in having kutis in the future. And with that kind of space, there is a potential for that. Stocker Road is quite small, but you can still, it is possible that the lay disciples are really keen. You could have a kuti for maybe a female tucked away, or a male disciple tucked away in a corner of the monastery. The monks are on one side, the male monastics on one side. There could be a kuti for a female practitioner in one corner of the property where they have their own facilities. So, but it all, you know, depends on dynamics, what people want to do, which way they want to take the monastery dynamics. And so that thing, instigating work projects, that's just one aspect of the person. You know, you've got Achyam Brahmali who has taken an incredible level of responsibility, for both small, medium, and, you know, extensive projects and teaching and traveling and social support over the years. But he is one of the best, say, senior teachers that I've seen, and I've met hundreds over the years. And I've sat next to Achyam Brahmali for how long now? 18 years, and he is a very, very pleasant companion. We have never ever had a fight. We have never had a major argument, you know, where we don't speak for days. There's a real aversion. Never ever. He's very, very easy to live with, to converse with, even though our personalities are quite different. So that thing, instigating work projects, is just one aspect of the person. It's not the whole person. And the second point, they take up disciplinary issues in the Sangha. So, you know, you could have some of these things are quite necessary, where monks or the senior monk or the abbot may have to act. You could have a junior person, you could have a community member who's just completely out of control. Their behaviour is just completely outrageous. You know, at Bodhinyana we're quite easygoing, we're reasonably flexible, we can accommodate different personalities, but we've got a very good team spirit. But if the person is absolutely out of control, then you're definitely going to have to do something about them. And these things may be quite necessary. You know, it's in the monastery, people just can't do whatever they like on a daily basis. So there may be, as far as Sangha regulation, there's no choice. You know, you have to take steps to keep certain individuals in check. But what happens as well is, you know, we're looking at it at a different time and sort of, say, cultural conditioning. When the Buddha was alive, when he was teaching the Sangha, you know, the Sangha of the Four Quarters, the monks and nuns and the male and female lay disciples, you know, life was much more simplistic, less demanding, less complicated. I mean, you know, if you were living in the time of the Buddha, maybe their idea of a work project is a major work project is maybe putting up a building the size of this hall might be the most incredible thing that they might do, or building a couple of kutis, you know, this kind of thing that we see, the buildings like this size, we see this all over Asia. This is nothing. If you've got the funds and you've got a huge team of engineers and workers, I mean, you know, they could put up a temple complex the size of this in 12 months, you know, complete. You know, you've got absolutely dozens of support members with your team. So they are, and that third point, they are hostile towards eminent bhikkhus, meaning they have, say, obvious dislike and aversion towards, say, senior monks, towards abbots, towards, you know, monks of real recognition, and even with the bhikkhunis as well, you know, senior female teachers who may be famous, have a very strong following, are world liked by the lay community, are very helpful, supportive, and are good role models, can lead, can instruct, may have very, very good personal qualities. But the person concerned, you know, they are hostile, they dislike, they have a sense of aversion towards this monastic. And why is that the case? You have situations where you have jealousy. That person annoys me. That person, I'm resentful of the fame, you know, the recognition, the popularity. There's something I just don't like about that person, you know, for my personal reasons. And but that kind of response, it may not necessarily, you know, it may not be justified whatsoever, but the person concerned, one thing that you see a lot is when people come out with that kind of behavior, it's because that person, the successful person, has got something that you don't have. And that's why you get all these sort of very unpleasant feelings coming up towards that person, because they threaten you in some way. They make you, even abbots go through this kind of experience, because this practice, it brings up, you go through a lot of emotional stuff in Dhamma practice, and even abbots can be contentious with each other, can be jealous and resentful of each other, and can quibble and snicker and talk about and find fault with other abbots or senior monks, because they may because of the success, popularity, the following, the financial resources, you know, because your monastery's got millions and millions of dollars, you can build almost anything you want, you have incredible support, and the support across the spectrum is just outstanding, and our monastery doesn't have that, or I don't have that level of recognition and following, even though I'm very, very smart, capable guy, that I don't have that same level of recognition and success. But this is all defilement. This is all, the stuff that we process on a regular basis. Especially the monks and nuns go through this all the time, every single day, for years, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. But you just have to get more skillful to work and balance out these forces and energies and the personality. Oh, God. This tablet's done something funny. Let me think. Okay, that next point. They are intent on lengthy and unsettled wandering. And I'm a little bit sort of argumentative with some of these principles, because we're looking at a very sort of It's almost like a narrow, simplistic kind of perspective. Like I'm not, you know, I'm not arguing with the Buddha, but there's more to it than that. We're looking at a different time and place. You know, modern, our current society is very complex, demanding. The technology is just incredible. You know, that we see, and you know, the most complex thing that they had at the time of the Buddha was maybe a horse-drawn cart, or maybe a wind, could be something like a windmill, you know, connected to a river, grinding flour, you know. So, you know, there's just no comparison. So, you know, they are intent on lengthy. One should not take as a friend, as a person who is intent on lengthy and unsettled wanderings. But I've met plenty, I mean, with the forest monks of the early Thai forest tradition, those monks who become great teachers, famous teachers in Thailand, Southeast Asia, and all, you know, essentially are known around the world in particular circles, in Buddhist circles, those particular senior monks, or you know, even junior senior monks, they were going on Tudong on a regular basis. They could have spent most of their early life on Tudong, wandering all over Thailand, Laos, or even possibly Burma. And so I that can be the reason why their practice, they were able to develop their practice to such a deep and profound level, because that's exactly what they did. That was a major causal factor. Some people will argue the point. I spoke to a very, very senior monk at Wat Pa Bantad, and he had been living at Wat Pa Bantad for, at that point in time, at like 40 years. And he had never gone anywhere else. He'd lived there all his life. And he was very, and I could believe it, he was believed by the Thais to be attained. And I wouldn't doubt it. I couldn't know for sure, but the quality of his practice reflected that again and again and again. And so in his case, staying put in one place and going nowhere at all for any length of time, maybe possibly visiting another monastery or helping with their, it could be sort of major electrical projects, electrical engineering, that worked very, very well for him. But, you know, you've got people who attain Dhamma by wandering and travelling on Tudong for a very large part of their early monastic career, to the point where they at least attain the first level, or they break right through to ultimate realization. So, you know, it's not that cut and dried. You're looking at there are multiple factors involved, and so, you know, you're looking at different strokes for different folks. Certain approaches will work very, very well for some people. Certain approaches will work very well for other people. And so, you know, it all depends on your character. These guys who like to go on Tudong on a regular basis weren't necessarily very social characters. They wanted to stay out of the crowd. They wanted to stay secluded, well outside the towns and villages. They didn't want to stay in main monasteries where they're mixing with absolute minimum 5-10 monks at any time, or even up to 50, 60, even 100, maybe in the Punsa. You're living with 100 other people, monastics in this community. And these particular individuals who are far more reclusive, far more secluded with their mentality, you know, wanted to keep
you know, right away from the crowd, from the monasteries, from you know, like village temples and this kind of thing. They like to practice by themselves, and they didn't like visitors. They don't like people coming round and just dropping in for a chat. to give an example, somebody was telling me that in Sri Lanka, there was a very senior monk there who lived by himself for years on end, like must have been at least 30 years plus. And he also had psychic ability. And when he knew, because you know, you can know from a distance, you can know things from a distance. And when he knew that people were coming to visit, he would just essentially just leave. He would grab his stuff, his umbrella tent, his basics, you know, a cloth to sit on, his bag maybe with a water bottle, you know, other little maybe little knickknacks, and then he would leave for the rest of the day. So those people who came from Kandy or Colombo or anywhere else would roll up at his kuti. They may have to walk through the forest. I mean, to get to his kuti, they may have to walk for like a full hour, in at least three quarters of a full hour in thick forest to reach his kuti. And, you know, you've got elephants, you've got leopards, you've got bears in different locations. And he was nowhere to be seen. Now, he just didn't want to be hanging out with anyone, even the other monks. He didn't want to live with other monks. But what he would do, he would come into Kandy once every 12 months for at least one or two days, and then he would meet with the Western monks, and they would sit and talk Dhamma and meditation and practice and problem solving and suttas, you know, the stuff that monks are interested in, and he would do that for an absolute minimum 1 to 2 days. And after the community business was wrapped up, then he would go back to his secluded kuti in the forest. And he would only do that once per year. And let's see, the person. Okay. And the person is unable to instruct, encourage, inspire, and gladden one from time to time with a Dhamma talk. So you're not taking a person as your friend who is unable to instruct, encourage, inspire, and gladden one from time to time with a Dhamma talk. I mean, all monks, and I've seen junior monks who are not very, very complicated individuals intellectually, are quite, even though they're well educated, but they're intellectually much more simple. It's almost like earthworm wisdom, and even these guys surprise me with the views and opinions they come out with in relation to Dhamma, could be certain characteristics or events in the monastery. And I thought, you know, you've got a spark of wisdom there. Even though some people might think you're a little bit slow, or you know, you just don't get things, you know, like really, really fast. And then they come out with some of the most interesting things, which even the guys who are twice as smart, you know, you don't hear from, you know, the guys who've got brain power. You get this simple person come out with something, and I thought, wow, that's pretty amazing. And you get someone who's twice as smart who never comes out with that kind of utterance or say way of looking or assessing a situation. So as you understand, the second half bhikkhu wants you to take as a friend a bhikkhu who possesses five other qualities. So we're looking at the complete opposite. You should take as a friend who does not instigate work projects, take up disciplinary issues, is not hostile towards eminent or senior bhikkhus, is not intent on lengthening unsettled wanderings, and is able to instruct, encourage, inspire, and gladden one from time to time with a Dhamma talk. One should take as a friend a bhikkhu who possesses these five qualities. And it's right, it's correct to a degree, but it's not correct completely, because you're looking at multiple factors. You're looking at a far more advanced, complicated, demanding society that we live in. Even with our forest monasteries, most of our monks, probably something like at least half of them, more than half at least, they can all do mechanical stuff, electrical stuff, plumbing and solar panels, and work on cars and pumps and this and that. So those five principles, there's much more to it. You're looking at, with each of those points, those five points, you could argue multiple factors behind each of those points that the Buddha brought forth, because we're looking at a different time and place. We're living in a much more advanced culture here. Okay, so were there any points, any views and opinions on that before I move to the fourth sutta? Okay, so I'll just bring it up. So that will be that fourth sutra called Asking Questions. That's on in Wisdom Publishing. That's page 777. And the Venerable Sariputta, who was one of the Buddha's two chief disciples, the two most powerful enlightened masters beside the Buddha himself. Friends, whoever asks another person a question does so for five reasons, or for a particular one among them. What five? One asks another person a question because of one's dullness and stupidity. One asks with evil desires, motivated by desire. One asks another person a question as a way of reviling the other person. One asks another person a question because one wishes to learn. And the fifth point, one asks another person a question with the thought, if when they are asked a question by me, he answers or she answers correctly, that is good. But if they do not answer correctly, I will give them a correct explanation. Friends, whoever asks another person a question does so for these five reasons, or for a particular one among them. Friends, I ask another person a question with the thought, if when they are asked a question by me, they answer correctly, that is good. But if they do not answer correctly, I will give them a correct explanation. So if I go back to the first point, a person asks another person a question because of one's dullness and stupidity. But the thing is that it doesn't mean, just because a person asks another person a question doesn't mean that person is dull and stupid. The Buddha said in other sutras that, the people who ask questions of others may have a genuine aspiration to learn and understand and increase their knowledge base. Sometimes people, I've seen people who are embarrassed to ask another person something, like when they don't know or if they don't understand, wasn't clear. It's embarrassing. They're afraid to ask, within their personality, they're afraid to ask others, if there's something they don't know. But you're looking at personality, like character traits. But it doesn't, people can ask that question which is outside
characteristics of dullness and stupidity. You could be the complete opposite. You're seeking for wisdom, understanding, which is the opposite of dullness and stupidity. The second point, one with evil desires, motivated by desire, asks another person a question. So maybe an example I can see is a person engages you, they connect with you, they get say chummy or buddy buddy with you to get something out of you on some level. And the person's intentions are unwholesome. The Buddha said, like evil desires, motivated by desire. So you're looking at, say, it could be unwholesome, selfish, greedy, perspective of mind. They're looking to gain something from their interaction with you. So that one's very hard. That one's a little bit hard to dispute, because people can question another individual with, I want to argue that point. It's pretty clear. There's not much sort of wiggle room with that one. One asks another person a question as a way of reviling. An example could be I could ask someone, it could be something like, say for example in the monastery, I could ask someone why is the floor of your kuti like covered with maybe 200 items and another 100 items outside, there's a pathway, but this comes back to mentality, and it's like there's just a path to reach the bed, there's a path to reach the gas heater, and every square centimeter on the floor is covered with stuff, with knickknacks, with little bits and pieces, with tools and like a screwdriver, Swiss Army knife, tissue box, anything you can possibly think of that monks are allowed to possess. There's just stuff everywhere, under the bed, all over the floor, up on the shelves, and I said to him, why have you got so much stuff? And he's, I wasn't attacking him. I can't live like that. It's it would just completely blow me away. So, he said, when I need something, he said, everything's here. If I need a screwdriver or an Allen key, a tissue, the spittoon is there, the water bottle is there, my MP3 player, my discs, which are fine. And, we're talking about, 200 items. But his mentality was, and it's a different kind of psychological state, is that whatever he needed was close to hand, was within, no more than, to reach under the bed, the farmost corner under the bed. You're only looking at maybe 6 feet. You would only have to crawl under the bed, if you could get that far, 6 feet to reach that item. But their mentality is, I don't have to go to the bathroom looking for this or that. I don't have to go to the workshop or anywhere else. From their perspective, it's just so convenient. Everything's there. So with that, as a way of reviling, asking a question as a way of reviling, what is your intention? Do I have the intention to humiliate you, embarrass you, put you down, or do I have a genuine need to understand something, or maybe somebody's opinion on some issue? There could be a number of approaches or takes on that perspective.
You know, reviling, you know, indicates that you have unwholesome intentions towards that person. Yeah. 1.4, one asks another person a question because one wishes to learn, and the vast majority of us, that's something that that we can relate to without difficulty. Yeah, if I need to clarify a point on meditation, I usually go to Achyam Brahm. If I need to know anything about, if I need any, if I need to know anything about, say, suttas or commentary, say even commentary to a small degree, or maybe some kind of historical or archaeological detail, then I ask Achyam Brahmali. If I need to know about, say like solar panels, electrical circuits, and fittings and switches, then I go to Venerable Radha. He's an electrical engineer, and he's just amazing. What he can do. He's just a hands-on man. He can do almost anything. And he was actually leading a team when he was in Malaysia. What would you call it, within the electrical fraternity. He was a team leader. So that wish to learn, the wish to know and understand and increase one's knowledge of the subject concerned. You know, we're looking at some kind of, it's almost like increasing one's, almost like one's personal development to a degree. Point five, or one asks another person a question with the thought, if when asked a question by me, if they answer correctly, that is good, but if they do not answer correctly, I will give them a correct explanation. So, if he is asked a question by me, he answers correctly, that is good. But if he does not answer correctly, I will give him a correct. Well, you know, the Buddha. There was examples of this in the sutras where the Buddha would question one of the monks, and he would get that monk to actually think and ponder and reflect on some behavior or some point of Dhamma. And in order to essentially raise up some understanding or insight in that particular individual. So, say for example, there was Venerable Samedi, the son of a fisherman who had a particular wrong view, and then the Buddha, you know, sort of question, didn't attack him, he questioned him, and questioned him with this kind of progressive kind of approach, and then in order to get the Venerable Samedi to realize the state, the course of his wrong view, so he questioned Samedi with a progressive talk for the purpose of getting him to realize what he was thinking was not in line with Dhamma. That was the Buddha's intention, what he was aiming at. So, does anyone have any views, opinions, whatsoever, on these four suttas that we have gone over? Can you talk right close to the mic?
Close.
What you fear, you might be what, overextending oneself? Or yeah, I think, I mean, some of these principles are a little bit too almost like simplistic, because we're looking at it's more complicated like that. So with the points that we see in this sutta and the ones we've discussed, there's a lot more to it. And I think the bottom line is, just that statement, the Buddha, to do good, refrain from evil and purify the mind. We don't necessarily have to get overly complicated and think, like when I'm engaging people, think too much. Exactly.
Yep. It's,
unfortunately, we're naughty on the outside of monasteries, and there's naughtiness on the inside too. It doesn't mean, I guess, just because somebody gets a robe on them and becomes at a monastery, they're not. We all make mistakes, don't we? No matter where we are.
Yeah, it's like the Buddha has the high. The Buddhas have the highest level of wisdom of all beings. But what he's doing, it's that same thing. You're looking at a different time and location and culture. Our life is far more complicated these days. There's just far more going on. So, some of these principles may be correct, but they're not. It's not totally right. There's much more to it. Well, it doesn't really need to be.
I know, that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, it doesn't, exactly. I think it's what people feel comfortable with the quality, the quality, the direction of their life. It's what they can manage, what they can deal with.
I think greed and materialism come into play and delusion. So if you've got delusion, how could you remove greed? Without removing the delusion first.
Like delusion's the parent of, say, like greed and anger. It's the parent.
How do you remove that in a materialistic society when it shortens our view, all this materialism?
Yeah, with each individual, people they look at their personal makeup and they think to themselves, well, what can I do to with each individual, the vast majority of the population would like to improve themselves and to be better people in society, and because all of us are just so different, that each individual the vast majority of people just do the best with what they've got, and only the individual concerned can really know which is the right way for them to go.
It's almost like we're blessed if we step out of it or not.
So the what?
Almost like we're blessed if we step it out of delusion or not, because you can try and step out of it, but it's not a guarantee. It's like it's almost like if you're we don't have a choice. You don't have a choice how you look. You don't have a choice. I don't have a choice how I look. Like you're either blessed with attracting the other sex or not. It's like you're blessed to be able to step out of delusion or not. It's almost like we don't have an option, and that comes through our experiences which we encounter in our life where we're born and everything like that, and we can't choose all of this. It's thrust upon us.
Yeah, but the whole thing with delusion, with defilements, you're looking at a essentially it's like it's a gradual path where people, they wear away these unwholesome tendencies. But you're looking at the vast majority of people, you're looking at several lifetimes to get enlightened.
Yes,
it's not like a flash in the pan, you know.
And if you want to chase it, well, desire is just going to create sorrow and disappointment. So if you desire to attain enlightenment, especially in this lifetime, well, you may well be setting yourself up for
I think regardless of the person and circumstances and this and that, the underlying factors and whatnot, you know, the big picture, that as long as people are moving in a wise direction, regardless of what's happening internally, externally, you know, they really can't go too far wrong. If your perspective, say for example, if I'm a very, very simple person and I think to myself, well, I just want to live a life which is based on wise principles, you know, that can just take you a long, long way, because wisdom, you know, you see wisdom in action, the way people think, the way they speak, the way they act, even the way a person walks the little puppy dog around the park, you know, the local park. Now, some people are absolutely brilliant the way they can understand and train and understand their pets. You know, so you're looking at experience and the wisdom faculty is there.
I reckon well said what you said before. As long as we're moving in the right direction, checking our motives, where they're at. A lot of people, we can't see where your motives are. Sometimes you can't see the stone at the bottom of the lake. But as long as we're moving in a good sort of direction, I agree. It doesn't have to be. Don't have to clean the whole 600 acre property in one day, do we? It takes time.
Okay, are we all done? Okay, we'll finish up. Thank you very much for your participation.